And so that's another thing, is like trying to take note of when I feel good, so that when I feel bad, I can say to myself, and I do literally out loud whisper to myself, you do not feel like this all of the time, Marcia. You do not feel like, you did not feel like this at 4 o'clock yesterday. And then having that letter written is a little bit more of evidence. You didn't feel like this at 4 o'clock yesterday. And look, you even wrote to your future self to tell her. Mm.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to the Feel Good Factor. I'm Susmita Veganosaurus, and I'm so glad you could join me here today. Hey everyone, I have a very special guest here today. Her name is Marcia Shander. So I discovered Marcia maybe just a few weeks ago when I was listening to her being interviewed on somebody else's podcast. And the moment I was listening to her, I'm like, oh my God, I need to get to know her and I need to have her and her awesome energy on my show. It was great. I was actually able to make a meeting with her, talk to her, get to know her. And then I've been reading a lot of information on her website and really enjoying it. Marcia is a very positive person and she is a master of storytelling. I want you all to get to know her story and I know you're all going to just really, really enjoy this episode. So here we go. Hey, Marcia.
Hi. I love that you call me a positive person because I think of you as such a positive, just joyful delight. Aww. And so I'm like real recognizing real. That's great. I do have the word yes tattooed on my finger. So I think that
there we go. Yes to positivity.
Yeah.
First of all, I was very curious to know. So your website and your whole brand is called Yes, Yes, Marcia. So why is it Yes, Yes, Marcia?
Well, it's because of that positivity. I did an exercise when I did a course years ago, 7 years ago, I did a course, Marie Forleo's course, B School, which is kind of about how to help you start up an online business. And one of the exercises she made us do at the beginning, which is a thing I think everybody on the planet should do, is we had to email 25 people we know, like people we know well, people we don't know well, and ask them, what are my three best qualities? And you can give them a survey so they can do it anonymously. And, you know, I was hoping like it would be like, she's funny, she's beautiful. You know, that wasn't what came up. Number one was kindness, which is very nice. And number two was positivity. And when it came to getting a website, my last name is, you know, it's hard to pronounce, it's hard to spell. And so I had a website that was my first and last name, but I didn't want to have something so complicated. And honestly, I went for Hello Marcia, but it was taken by somebody else. I typed in Hi Marcia, but when it's all one word, and bear in mind I'm English, it looks like it's saying him, arse, ha. And so I didn't want people to be like, who's arse? and so I looked at those traits and I thought, well, I can't be like kind Marcia. That's a bit of a weird thing, especially as a British person who lives in Canada. You know, it's very, very embarrassing to talk about yourself like that. And so positivity was number two. So, and I was going to put yes, Marcia, but somebody else had it on Twitter already. And so I thought, what if I just say yes, yes, Marcia? And honestly, at the time I was like, oh, this is so silly. I'm going to have to change it. And then it's just served me so well because it's kind of silly and a bit strange and people remember it. And, you know, now when I go to conferences, people go, yes, yes, Marcia. Like that's a thing that they say. And I do have this tattoo now that says yes on my finger, which is sort of separate from that. Anyway, and so it served me really well. I have a little hand symbol I do at the beginning of my videos. I stole it from the village people because they do hand symbols in YMCA. So I took the Y and the M from YMCA. and it's really great. And actually, when I first did it, I was meeting with a friend of mine and he gave me a funny look and he said, it sounds a bit like somebody's, you know, having a sexy time with you. And I said, but if they are, that it's clearly going very well. It suggests I'm very good at sexy time, so I'm okay with that.
it really suits you because, like you said, it brings out that personality of, yes, positivity, yes, but also, like you said, silliness, funniness. You have like this great sense of humor, making people laugh. And it's a lot of fun to say, yes, yes, Marsha, you know.
It's fun, isn't it?
it's harder to... I think people won't remember your last name so much. They'll be like, oh, yes, yes, Marsha, right? They would probably never say you're Marsha Shander. They'll be like, who's that?
Well, even when I worked in radio in the UK, I didn't use my last name because it was such a strange word and it's not quite spelled exactly how it sounds. And actually in the UK, there's so few people called Marsha. It's not a very popular name there that I just was Marsha. So my name on the radio was just Marsha. Like Prince or Madonna. I just had one name. I loved it. And it was kind of, I feel like it's also nice that it gives me a little bit of anonymity, you know, as well.
Yeah.
There's a kind of separation. And I think just, you know, sometimes from overly keen fans, certainly when I was on the radio, but also just even in terms of, you know, activism, that I am somewhat try and be an activist and have lots of friends who are. And I know that in data protection, the data protection laws and anti-terrorism laws mean that it can be kind of dangerous to be an activist. You know, the ways certainly that our governments here in Canada and in the US and in the UK, that they could just arrest you and never tell you why. And so having, again, a level of anonymity, I think, is not a bad thing.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. And I mean, look at me, even me, I'm not really known for my last name.
Right.
I, you know, I'm known as Veganosaurus, right? So it's fun and yeah, a little bit of that additional anonymity. Where does your name come from? Because you were saying it's the UK, it's a rare name. So where does your name come from?
So I'm Russian. My dad lived his whole life in Russia. My mum grew up in England, but her mum, my granny, actually lived in Russia till she was five, and then she had to flee the Bolsheviks and move to Turkey and then eventually back to the UK, which is where my mum grew up. And so I lived in Russia when I was very little, just until I was two. But my name comes from my dad. It's actually a Hungarian name. It means Alexander. But what's nice about it is I am what's known as a Googlewack, where I don't think there's another Marsha Shander in the whole world. If you Google Marsha Shander, I'm the only thing that comes up. Although there is a place in India called the Shandor Pass, where apparently it's very beautiful. I've never been. I would love to go. But yeah, it's not a very common name. And I kind of like that. I kind of liked having a bit of a special name. And Marsha, I think Marsha in North America is much more common. Everybody knows there's a TV show called The Brady Bunch. And one of the characters would say, all I ever hear is Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. And so everywhere I go in Canada and the US, people say that to me. But in the UK, it's not really a very well-known name. And so I quite like, you know, I'm a bit like being a bit special and different. So it's nice having a name that makes me feel a bit special and different.
You mentioned your grandmother, and I think I'm in love with her. And I love how you know, whenever you sing songs that she sang to you, and I love that voice you do.
Oh, thank you.
It's just so nice to get to know about her, or, you know, or rather like your experience with her. And it's so lovely. So, you know, the impressions, so coming back to that, you just did the Brady Bunch thing and then I'm talking about, you know, grandmother and all that. So were you always good at impressions? Were you always good at like slightly switching your voice?
It's funny because I don't think of myself as being good at impressions. I'm really bad at accents. Even I've been in Canada for 10 years and I cannot do a good Canadian accent. I can do, you know, that there's certain accents I can do that if I do them here, people are impressed. If I do a Scottish accent in front of Canadians, they're like, wow, that's really good. But if I do it in front of anybody from the UK, they're like, what? Is there something wrong with your mouth? Like, what's happening? And I think with my granny, you know, I grew up with my granny who had this accent that was kind of Russian Turkish because she moved to Turkey when she was a little girl, but then she went to a Russian school and her family was still, you know, the other refugees that she was with were all Russian. And so she had this thick accent. It's not like Russian is sort of a bit more yes. Whereas my granny was like, yes, Marsha, come here. And then and then I grew up with my uncle Boris, who was from her first marriage, who grew up in Turkey, also had this thick accent. Boris, much more clipped like this. And so I think I can do the accents of my family that were around me, but I'm not that good at other ones. But it's funny, you mentioning that, like what you say that's so nice about getting to know my granny is that telling a story about my granny was my route into storytelling, because I had got really obsessed with, so storytelling is the thing that I teach the most. And I had got really obsessed with a podcast out of the US called The Moth, which is, it's a live storytelling show, and they turned it into a podcast, and I would listen to it all the time. And then I was living in the UK at the time, and I thought, there has to be something like this in London. You know, there's everything in London. And so I looked up, and sure enough, I found a show called True Stories Told Live. And I went along a few times, and then I pitched to tell a story. And I pitched to tell this story about my granny, which I think is the story you've heard. I put some in the blogs that you mentioned, but there's also a story on YouTube of my granny. And what was so amazing was when I told this story, I felt like I got to see her again. She died about 3 years before, and we were very close. She brought me up, and it felt like I got to spend time with her, and it was so wonderful. And whenever I've told that story to a captive audience since, it feels that way. It feels like I get to see her. And I've since learned what's happening in the brain when you're telling a story is that your brain actually thinks the story's happening to you. They've done studies where they look at people's brains and your brain lights up as if you are experiencing the story. And it's the same for anybody listening. So if you feel like you got a sense of knowing my granny, it's because your brain was acting as if you were with her. And so that's so wonderful for me, you know, and I've told stories since of other people that I've lost. My uncle Boris died a few years ago, and I once told a story about him. And honestly, I told it because I was like, I want to see him again. I want to feel like I get to spend time with him again. So it's quite a profound thing, I think, about storytelling, that you get to, it's like time travel. And sometimes time travel involves seeing people that you don't otherwise get to see. You know how when you dream about somebody, I don't know if you've ever lost somebody and then you dream about them, and it feels like you get to see them, or even just a friend you haven't seen for a while, it feels like you spent time with them. And so telling a story is kind of like dreaming when you're awake, but you get to choose what you're dreaming about.
Yeah, that's so beautiful the way you put it. And it's so, so true. I'd never thought of it that way exactly as such, but you're right. Like when somebody passes away and then, you know, a few years later, like last evening, I was sitting with my parents and we were thinking of my granny and her sisters and, you know, all the guests who used to visit us when we were growing up, and talking about them, their traits, going into those little details that really did bring them alive for us. But I do believe, yes, you know, you don't have to be very good at storytelling to be able to feel this connection that you're talking about. But if you are as talented as you are, and if you are so good, then I do believe it becomes even more stronger. So how can people do that? How can they get better at telling stories? Because I do know you have a method that you have studied, and, you know, you've broken down your own experience into a method, and then you teach that. So what do you share with people about that?
So the first thing to say is that often people think that the most important thing in a story is the narrative, is what happened. And actually, that's not true, you know, because we've all had an experience of, we all have that one person in our life who they can tell any story and it's fascinating. And we all have had an experience of sitting next to somebody who we know did something interesting, but oh my gosh, when are they going to stop talking because they're so boring and want to fall asleep? And what happens is they're just not, the second person is not following the rules of storytelling. That I think there's a big myth that you're born a good storyteller or you're not, and that's it. And it's just not true. It's absolutely a set of rules that anyone can follow. And the most important one of those rules is that when you're telling a story, you're making a movie inside your listener's brain. So if you think about movies, there are three different kinds of scenes. You have voiceover scenes. So voiceover is disembodied voice from the future giving context or philosophy. So if you think about the example I often give is the one at the beginning of The Shawshank Redemption, where you have Morgan Freeman saying, "There must be a con like me in every prison in America." And so he's kind of telling you the context and telling you the philosophy and telling you some things, you know, that have happened already. So that's voiceover. And then you have montage, and montage is lots of scenes done in real time, but cut together with music. Mm-hmm. And they use them to show something changing or just passage of time. So, you know, like the Rocky training montage, or in a romantic movie, the montage of getting to know each other, or in any movie where somebody has to learn a dance, you know, we have a montage of learning the dance steps. And they do that so that we don't have to watch 15 hours of footage of them learning dance steps, or 15 hours of footage of them going on a date and, you know, paying for the tickets at the movie theater and then going in and getting a seat and going to get popcorn, you know, so that it saves us a lot of time in the movie. And then there's action scenes. An action scene is everything is happening in real time, sometimes slow-mo, but usually real time, all from the perspective of one or a couple of the characters. So if you think about movies, most movies are mostly made up of action scenes. And I don't even mean like there's a car chase or there's a fight. I just mean like a scene that everything is happening in real time. And you know, if you had a whole movie that was voiceover, that would be a boring movie. If you had a whole movie that was montage, you wouldn't be engaged. And so it's the same when it comes to telling stories. And the difference between those three kind of scenes and stories is to do with granular sensory detail and emotion. So voiceover in storytelling context and philosophy might be saying, when I was 19, I went traveling around Europe. I visited 9 different countries. I felt it was important to meet people from different cultures and expand my horizons. So you have a sense of what I did. You know my opinion on what I did, but you don't actually know what that trip was like. Montage is little flashbulbs of pictures. So when I was 19, I went traveling around Europe. We drank red wine in Paris. We walked the streets of Berlin. We looked at the canals in Amsterdam. So again, you know more about what I did, but you don't know what that trip is like. But then action scene is getting super granular and saying, I'm standing on the subway in Paris when this woman gets up and starts walking towards me and I panic because I don't speak French. And then she says in perfect English, I'm terribly sorry, you seem to have dropped your 200 franc note. And that's action scene. And that's where all the magic happens. That's where our brains think the story is happening to us. And you as the listener feel like it's happening to you. And the way that you write an action scene is you just keep answering the questions. What did it look like or feel or smell or sound like? And how did you feel? And you make sure you have that emotion in it, because that's how we can relate to anything. You know, you were just talking about your granny. I'm guessing your granny probably wasn't a Russian lady who lived, you know, half her life in Turkey and half her life in England. But you know how it feels to sit with your granny and hold her wrinkly hand as she's singing. And so you can connect with that story through the sensory details and through the emotions, because we've all experienced most sensory details and we've all experienced most emotions. And so that's how you can relate to any story. And it's also what the emotions are, what makes us care. Because if you say, I sat down next to my granny, we might be like, okay. But if you say, I sat down next to my granny and I was terrified, then we're like, ooh. Or I sat down next to my granny and I was so happy, then we're like, ah. And it connects us to the story and it makes us interested and it creates, you know, sometimes it creates tension, like in the example of saying, and I was terrified, because then we want to know why, you know, why were you terrified? As humans, we're very curious. So that's the main thing, is tell action scenes. And if you need to tell a story that spans any length of time, you just choose a few action scenes and then you can use voiceover or montage to jump between them. But because obviously you can't tell the whole story in action scene, because nobody has 5 years to listen to your story. And a lot of that story would be boring. You know, you're buying the popcorn, mm-hmm. you're getting to find your seat. You don't need to describe every bit of that in detail. But really those action scenes are where all of the magic happens. So what did it look like or smell or sound or taste like? And how did you feel?
Wow, you are right. But I've been reading up on your blog posts about the stories, and I tried this. I've been applying that when I've been writing too. In the sense of, I do have a tendency to do voiceover and action scenes, but then I try to give more weightage to action scenes.
Great.
Ever since I got to know about you. And, you know, especially reading all your posts, right? I'm like, yes, action scene. Is this action? No. How did I feel? What did this feel like? And I can see people responding in a certain way.
Oh, great.
You know, and they're interested. But how do you, you know, the granular details, that's what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. How do you know what to pick and what to leave out?
So you always want to ask yourself a question at the beginning. And the question is, what am I trying to get across with this story? And sometimes that's a message. You know, sometimes that's customers can surprise you, or mindfulness is important, or whatever it is. And sometimes that's a bit of narrative. Sometimes it's when I go shopping with my mom, she spends a lot of money. And so then whenever you're editing, and there's a, I have a big hero, this lady, Marion Roach Smith, who wrote a book called The Memoir Project. And she talks about what she calls the vomit draft, where she says your first draft has to just be everything. And I've since learned that the different parts of our brain, the parts of our brain we use to write and the parts of our brain we use to edit are completely different parts of our brain. So we cannot edit as we're writing. And so it's really important that the first draft is just everything, you know, in the kitchen sink. And then when you go back to edit, if you've asked yourself, what am I trying to get across? Then you can ask yourself at every point, do I need this to get across what I'm trying to get across? And sometimes that's going to be bits of narrative. You know, say you're telling a story about how your mum spends a lot of money when you go shopping with her, and you're telling the story about going out to the shops, and then halfway through this woman comes walking down the street dressed as a giant rabbit and starts breakdancing and it was amazing and there's a big crowd and everyone's clapping, and then you keep going. You have to ask yourself, do I need that part to get across that my mom spends a lot of money? No, I don't. So you cut it and trust that you'll use it somewhere else. Maybe somewhere else you're telling a story about how, you know, don't expect that your day will be normal because you never know when a giant rabbit's going to come along. And you can use that there. And then I think also with details, you know, sometimes it is important to have some, you don't want to say, I walked into a room, there was a person there, we said some things. You know, you need to have some details. But in terms of the sensory details, some people say, oh, I don't like to edit my stories. But everybody edits our stories. Otherwise, every single story we tell would go, I opened the door, I stepped through the door, I stepped into the room, I looked down, there were, you know, wooden slats on the floor. There was 75 slats and they were joined with black, you know, it would be bananas and it would go on for 4 years. You would never get through any story. And so it's just asking yourself, what do I need to get across? I often say to people, if they're saying they're sitting in a room, describe how big the room is, because if it's a tiny closet or if it's a giant warehouse, that makes a difference to us. And so, you know, if you say I'm in the kitchen, I'm in the bedroom, we can have a pretty good sense. But if you say I'm at work, like, are you in a cubicle? Are you in your own office? Are you standing in a factory? Are you working behind the bar? Like, give us just a little bit of something. If you're working in a bar, what kind of bar is it? Like, is it sleek metal or is it old fashioned wood? Just give us a little bit of something so we have a good sense. But you don't need to describe every single shelf and every single glass.
That makes so much sense. And what I like best about everything you said is that you can actually save the parts, because I mean, that rabbit down the street is gold and I don't want to throw that out, but use it somewhere else, right? Yeah. That's a good thing.
Yeah. And so have somewhere that you keep. So everybody, if they want to tell stories, have somewhere where you keep ideas and everything you see, write it down. And then when you need a story, you can look through and be like, oh, I could write about that, or I could write about this. So yeah, always have a place to keep them. Same with ideas. Otherwise, they just bounce around your head trying to get noticed. So have a place where you write them down.
Oh yeah, that really helps. I do that with ideas now. I've learned the hard way that I better do that. Otherwise, either I forget them or I try to do everything at once and then just doesn't work, right? Like you just do one thing at a time. So.
Yes.
So I'm curious. So do you do, because, you know, everything that you're talking about the stories and the details, you know, the feelings and all of that, this is a technique all of us use in visualization and manifestation too. So is that something you practice?
It's, I mean, I've been a furious daydreamer since I was very young. And I have sometimes, you know, I'm sort of in the self-development world. So I've definitely run into it and done classes and courses where we do. I don't know that it's something I especially do, although I feel like there is a certain... So I'm somebody who like has one foot in woo and one foot in, you know, science and logic. And so... But I really, the more I do woo-woo things, the more I realize there's almost always a practical element to it. So if you were to sit and visualize, maybe you're calling it in through manifestation, or maybe just when that opportunity shows up, you're more likely to orient yourself towards it. You know, you're more likely to notice potential opportunities because you've already been thinking to yourself, this is a thing I want to do. Mm. And so, you know, even in the same way, I feel like I just had a tarot reading and I was saying, it's a friend of mine that does it. And I was saying, she's called Katie Braha. And I was saying to her, even if, you know, sometimes it's just a way to help me look at things differently. Like maybe there was a time I was going through something very difficult and then I looked at my tarot reading for the year and it had said, this is a period where you're going to be really learning about things. And even if that was just nonsense that, you know, she just made up, it made me able to look at what I was going through as a learning experience instead of just this terrible, horrible, awful thing that I was going through. Mm-hmm. And so it helped mm-hmm. me have a different angle. So I think in the same way with manifestation, I feel like I think even at the, it's even if doing it is just an exercise in knowing what you want, because it's much easier to get what you want when you're clear on it rather than I just would like some nice things to happen, that you're much more likely to look for those opportunities or work for them or notice them when they show up.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. But it, yes, it makes sense and comes down to this thing of practice it and, you know, no matter in which way, but yes, it's going to work for your benefit and it's always good to daydream.
Yeah, exactly. And it's fun. And it's fun.
It's so much fun. You know, I was looking at your world domination summit thing. Mm. So you were sharing the story of how you had envisioned it would be, right? Mm. So, yes. And then that whole thing, though it wasn't exactly the way you thought it would be, the fact that you dreamt of it so much and wanted to be a part of it so much that you picturized it so clearly, I do believe that is what, you know, finally, either if I'm talking on manifestation terms and opened the opportunity for you, or if you're talking in terms the way you are saying that, you know, you were so receptive to it when it did open up.
It's not just that I was receptive to it, but I asked. So I went, mm-hmm. so the story is that this conference, World Domination Summit, I started going in 2013, and every year I would sit in the audience and think, oh, you know, if I was doing a keynote, what would mine be about? Can I tell you a story? This is an awful story to admit, but I think it's kind of funny. But a few years before I did my talk, it was the third day of the conference, and it had been a very emotional conference for me and a very emotional day. I'd made friends with this lady, Samantha Nolan Smith, who was incredible. And she and I had just had this big, you know, deep talk, sitting in the park, crying. And I was sat in the final session, and there was a speaker who I just didn't quite connect with. You know, we don't connect with every single speaker. And so instead I thought, what would my talk be about? And so I started imagining my talk and I imagined this part of it, and it was the only part that actually stayed in the final talk. It's the last couple of minutes. But in the moment, I was so moved by my own imaginary talk that I started crying.
Oh,
if this speaker looks down, she's going to be like, wow, I really moved that girl. but I daydreamed. And then with WDS, I first did a workshop. So I got asked to come and help them coach the storytellers because they have attendee storytellers. And then I really wanted to do a workshop. And I, you know, like most people, thought, well, they will come to me and say, oh, Marsha, we'd love you to do a workshop. And of course, that most of the time doesn't happen. And so very awkwardly, sitting in a small windowless office with Jolie Guillebeau, who's one of the organizers, I sat and went, Jolie, I'd really like to teach sometime if you think that would be okay. Like, it was not bold. And she went, oh yeah, let's get you doing a workshop next year. And I was like, oh, that was easy. So I did a workshop. It went really well. It was the first to sell out. And then I did another one the following year that again went really well. And then I got an email from the organizer, Chris, from the head organizer, Chris Guillebeau. And he said, what would you like to do next year? And I said, I would love to do a keynote. And I think I felt bold enough to ask it because I had been imagining it. So I'd already cried. I'd already made at least one person cry, me. And if I hadn't, you know, I maybe wouldn't have been audacious enough to ask because I wouldn't have been thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it. And that doesn't always happen. Like,
you know, when people think about things, there are two ways they think about it, right? Like people can think about it and then think about how it can go wrong and panic. And even that is daydreaming, even that is imagination. You know, people can use their imagination. But when you use it the way you did, like, what could go right? What could go better? Oh my God, this is getting better. And but, you know, that is visualization right there, right? So that positive way of looking at it and thinking it. And it's so beautiful, the journey where things opened up, then you took the step. Then again, something opened up and then you took the further step. Like the way it worked is right. So beautiful to hear.
And I should add that I do the other thing too. I mean, that whole talk is about what I call your beast, which is the little creature that sits in your ear when you're about to pitch the talk and says, no one's going to give you a talk. No one wants to hear what you have to say. And I also imagined all the ways that it would go horribly wrong, which for me mostly was about I wouldn't do enough preparation and I'd forget what I was saying and I'd regret not having done more work on it. And I was, to my shame, 2 hours before the talk, I was in my hotel room rewriting parts of the talk that I was about to do. Like the, I mean, that was, in many ways, that was the biggest talk of my career on a personal level, because even though I've done talks to bigger audiences, that was one that, you know, I first went to WDS in 2013. I just started my business and so I had sort of grown up in that conference, and so it was so important to me to do it. And I was the closing keynote on the penultimate year ever of the conference, and so I do daydream the other things. But another thing on that, I've learned a really important lesson from my mum a few years ago. So when I worked in radio, I worked at a station called XFM. I was a radio DJ, and it was a sort of smallish indie station, but it was owned by the same company that owned the biggest pop station in the whole of London, one of the biggest radio stations in the whole country. Certainly, I think outside of the national stations, it was the biggest. And there was the breakfast show that was hosted by this very famous guy called Johnny Vaughan, who was like on TV all the time. And this was the radio station that I had grown up. It's called Capital Radio. I'd grown up listening to it. I could sing you every single Capital Radio jingle from the 90s. I somehow ended up, by a series of sort of accidental conversations, auditioning to be the co-host on this show. And I knew that the previous co-host had been paid £100,000 a year. This is, you know, bear in mind, this is 15 years ago. So if you adjust for inflation, that's a lot of money. And I went for the job, and then I was waiting to find out. And my mum said to me, oh, I love when they say you might have the job, because then you can really daydream and enjoy it. And then even if you don't get the job, you had a lovely time in the run-up. And the thing was, my usual instinct was, oh, don't dream about it, because then I'll just get my hopes up and then I'll be disappointed. And that's what I always used to do. And when my mom said that to me, I thought, you know what? Every single time I've gone for something and I didn't allow myself to daydream, I was still really disappointed. Like it didn't protect me from being disappointed. And so I did that. I really daydreamed. I spent that £100,000. I met all the celebrities, because, you know, all the most famous celebrities would come on that show. And I, you know, and I was stepping out in London and getting up at 3 a.m. and being part of that team. And then I didn't get the job, but I did have a really good time. And so I've kind of done that ever since. That, you know, there was a point where somebody from Penguin Random House approached me and asked if I would pitch a book. And I, oh my gosh, Susmita, I was in my brain, I was hanging out with Oprah. I was being interviewed by Brené Brown. I was like, somebody told me Oprah has a cruise. I was a guest on Oprah's cruise, you know, and I had such a good time. And then eventually they said no to that book. Like there's still something I'm talking about pitching them a different book. But anyway, they said, but it was fine because I'd already had so much of the good time in my brain. And so that's another benefit of daydreaming, is that you get, you know, and as we know from storytelling, and as you probably know from visualization, the brain responds as if it's already happening. So it feels really good. And with that, what there was one point with, gosh, with there was one conversation I had with a book where somebody was saying, you know, we want to get a six-figure contract. So $100,000 US, which is much more than Canadian dollars. And between that first conversation and when they said no, I was telling everyone about it. And one friend said, but aren't you worried that you know, if it doesn't happen, it'll then be embarrassing that you've told all these people. And I'd said, it's such an unlikely thing to happen. But nobody's going to be like, oh, wow, you didn't just earn $100,000 out of nowhere, you loser. People would just be like, yeah, that super unlikely thing to happen didn't happen. That seems pretty normal. And so that's what I think. I think when there's a maybe, you know, always keep in your heart that it might not happen. Always keep that possibility in, you know, expect the worst, hope for the best is what people say. But like daydream and enjoy it, because really anything, you know, it's so much fun, and then you can have a really good time. And then if it didn't happen, as my mom says, if it doesn't happen, you at least you had a really good time in your head.
Gosh, I love that. I absolutely love that, because like you said, a lot of the time people are afraid to have hope or to express that or to dream, you know, to dream like the way you do. You're like, oh no, I'm going to jinx it, or or I'm going to be disappointed. And, you know, these thoughts that people do have. But I absolutely agree with your mom. I'm so in alignment with this whole teaching of just dream and just enjoy it and just visualize it. See, the thing about when we speak about visualization and all these things, it's this. You already act as if it has happened in your mind, right? Or even in your case, even in reality, talking to people about it, it's like you're beyond it. It's not picturing you, oh, congratulations, you got the job. No, it's like spending the 100,000, meeting Oprah, you know? The next steps after that, right? That is just that is the exact formula. And it's not just the thinking or like being in, it's not about being in denial and just saying it, but it's the feeling, you know, the power is in that, right?
Yeah, I do an exercise when I run workshops, and actually on my so I'm going to make a secret webpage. If you're listening, I'm making you a secret webpage, which is just going to be yesyesmarsha.com/veganosaurus. And on there, I'll put the links to people I've been talking about, like Marianne Roach Smith and Katie Braha, and I'll put a video about how to tell stories. But I on there as well, you'll see a thing to sign up to my mailing list. And with that, when you do, there's a link to an audio, so you can do a visualization about, and this is, I mean, it's probably very similar to things that you have, Susmita, because it says visualization, and the idea of it is to connect with where you feel emotion in your body so that you can describe it for stories. But the thing that I get people to do is think about a very exciting thing that's going to happen that could happen in the next year. And whenever I do this exercise live, everybody's faces afterwards, people are high. You get them to really imagine being in that place where the exciting thing has happened, and what did it smell like, and what did it physically feel like, and how did you feel, and where is it in your body? And people come out of it like, woo, smiling. And I did an exercise like that with somebody recently, with a client, and she came out of it and she said, wow, it just goes to show you that time really isn't linear, is it? Because in your brain you can jump around, you know, whether it's going back to see my granny, whether it's going forward to spend that $100,000 that I just got. And so it's really, yeah, I think it's a lovely thing. And I think where it's dangerous is if you think that there's absolutely no way it's never not going to work, and then it's sort of traumatic for you, or it's grief for you. But in my experience, you are probably going to have some of that grief anyway. Not getting excited does not protect you from disappointment and grief when you don't get the thing. And so why not get excited? If it's not going to protect you, why not just do it and have a good time?
Yeah. And it's not just that. Because you are feeling so good, you're obviously happier, you're more joyful. Your chances are you're going to do better. You're going to cope, and you have like, okay, there is a point to life. And then if things don't work out the way you imagined they would, it doesn't matter, because ultimately, whatever made you feel those feelings, something else will happen that will make you feel that way. Like what you were saying, like, you know, whatever you were imagining, or what you were dreaming about, rather, about being the radio jockey, get, you know, for being a co-host, and that didn't work out, but you still got to enjoy the experience of, you know, hosting a radio show, and then also like doing what you love doing, you know. Right. I do believe It's very, very apparent in all your videos, your talks. And by the way, I have to say to everybody, so the 5-part blog post series, you have to put that in the secret link, the link to the series. And I have to recommend this to everyone. While you're reading the post, listen to the audio also. And there is magic in Marsha's, the way she speaks, the way, you know, you're really there a lot more, you know, it's like double the dose of it than just reading it. So definitely listen if you can. It's very apparent that you love what you do and it brings you so much happiness and joy. And I do believe it's all, you know, it is also, you would say, a benefit of the way you think about daydreaming and visualizing and just enjoying life that way. So that is why I do believe your life is like this.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm really, yes, I feel like I'm very, very lucky. And I think, yes, I think a lot of it's because I'm happy. And I also recognize that I have enormous amounts of privilege, you know, even just on a basic level that I'm, that I am, as my friend Rick says, we're on the easiest settings on the video game of life, in that I'm white, I'm cis, I'm non-disabled, I'm queer, but straight people tend to assume that I'm straight. And so there's lots of barriers that I have absolutely not faced. And even, you know, I grew up in the country, I lived a huge chunk of my life in the country that I had the citizenship of, and now I'm not in a country that I have citizenship of, but I speak the dominant language, you know, and so I have all of those privileges. And I feel like I just mentioned that because I think for a long time I was like, yeah, I'm successful because I'm happy and I'm positive and I work hard. And then I learned about, like, oh yeah, and also people are sort of and even like cheerfulness, I think, is a privilege, because
sure,
when I walk around the world, unless I'm in Southeast London or unless I'm in, you know, New York, when I have to put my mean face on, generally I walk around the world just smiling and smiling at everyone. And it's been safe for me to do that because I don't look like a target to people. And so that makes my life easier, that when I walk into places, I'm cheerful and it's very easy for me to be cheerful. And so I do think that that's a privilege as well, because I know some people for whom it's really hard to feel to walk around being cheerful and having a cheery disposition. And that's, you know, whatever the combination of privilege and genes and my mother, who, if you met her, I think you would like even more than you like me. and I'm interested in things, and I feel like even that's another, you know, that's kind of a lucky privilege, because it means I pretty much enjoy talking to anyone, because I am interested in getting to know different kinds of people. And so, you know, and I'm curious about everything. I mean, when my mother comes to stay, it drives me up the wall. Everything she's asking. The other one time, I think after like 3 days of her relentlessly asking questions, we were on the subway and she just saw a bunch of cars and she said, now is that a car park or is that a car showroom? And I went, I don't know everything about Toronto. I apologize to her afterwards, my poor mother. But it does make my, you know, it means it's really hard to bore me, because I just will pick up a, you know, I'll pick up a Kleenex and be like, oh, how do they make these Kleenex? Oh, I see that there's like 1 or 3 different layers and there's perforations around the end. I wonder if that's a machine that makes that, or, you know, and so.
Curiosity. Yeah. You take everything by curiosity. That is just such a beautiful way to live.
Yeah. And again, I feel like it's a beautiful way to live, but it's a lucky way to live, because I know people who get bored easily and it's horrible for them. It's horrible. Mm-hmm. I know you can cultivate curiosity, but when you naturally, same with curiosity and cheerfulness, when it comes very naturally to you, it's, I think, a much easier life in ways than for people who have to work hard at it.
It's so true. No, I absolutely agree with you. And I feel lucky very often about my cheerfulness. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like, okay, people are always like, oh, you're a ray of sunshine and you're cheerful and all these things. And this is the first thing people do say about me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do believe it's also a practice you have to cultivate, yes, because of course we're human. It's very easy to go down this path of, oh my God, everything's horrible and what's the point of life and blah, 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 the beast, you know.
Right.
So you go, it's easy to go down that path, but to be able to, or rather to want it. Like I feel like very often people, and I absolutely agree with you that yes, not everybody is privileged enough to do it. But what I also see is even if people are privileged, it's not that they're always thinking this way or being positive or wanting to be happy. Like, this awareness that you have about your privilege that you spoke about, it grounds you, but it does not pull you down under right. that level. But there are many people who are like, oh, there's so many people suffering. This is, you know, all this is happening in the world. And then they let themselves be brought down. And the one thing I believe is that if you are privileged, use that privilege, yes, to help others, bring awareness and all that, but also use it to your advantage, for your feel goodness, to make yourself happy. Because only then, when your cup is full and you're happy and you're cheerful, you can uplift others. Because if somebody is down and you're putting this positive energy on them, no matter how difficult their life is, somewhere you're lighting some kind of spark, right? Some kind of joy you're bringing into their life. And I feel like, you know, if you're privileged, then try to go towards that, you know, towards your, you know, use that, lean into that.
Right, right. And I also have started to recognize that some people really enjoy being unhappy. I had a relative that I had to buy a Christmas present from, and I was so stressed about it. And I was talking to a friend and I was saying, oh gosh, I have to buy this present for this relative and I really love them, but they're so judgmental about everything all of the time. I just know I'm going to buy them something and they're going to be judgmental about it. And she said, clearly this person loves being judgmental. The greatest Christmas gift you could give her is to give her something that she can then be judgmental about.
I love that. Yes.
You know, I have a friend, the Mother's Day is a different date in North America than it is in the UK. And and I have some English friends here, and I once was popped around in the evening, sort of early evening, late afternoon, early evening. And I saw one of them and I was like, Dave, it's Mother's Day. Did you call your mum? And he's like, oh no, I forgot. So he rings his mum back in the UK and just, oh, you know, here you are. Finally, I've been waiting all day for a phone. And afterwards he said, that was really the greatest gift I could have given her, because I didn't forget, but she got to be judgmental and cross with me.
Oh my God. So, you know, this is unconditional love. You see what they like. And even, you know, this is something that I have been learning. There are no good or bad feelings or whatever. It's like for your better, you know, whatever path you are in your life, fair enough. And there are people around us who will be this way. And I love that you can actually, you know, not only acknowledge it, not only get put off by it, but also say, how can I support it, you know?
Yes. I mean, I say this now, but I think it's easy with people we don't know that well. And when it's people we know well, it becomes, oh, you're just out to get me. And I hate this. Why are we different? And why can't we think the same about everything? But it's constantly, it's a work in progress. And I think you're right. You know, one of the big journeys for me in the last few years, I am privileged enough to be in therapy and to have been for a long time, but is learning that it's okay to have feelings. Because even though my family were Russian, I grew up mostly in the UK, where it really isn't okay. You can be happy. That's the only feeling you're allowed. Maybe angry. But generally, I kind of grew up with this messaging that it's that, you know, don't have feelings. And I had so many of them. And so I was, you know, always like, what's wrong with me? And just learning that like, oh, it's okay. Today is a sad day and I'm feeling really sad and that's okay. And I just have to accept that it's not going to be, you know, today's an angry day. I just have to accept that that's what's happening and not try and fight it. Because I find the only way out is through when I try and fight those feelings. They double down, you know, when I try and get the sad off me or get the anger off me. And the quickest way really to deal with them is to kind of, you know, it always feels like the emotional equivalent of sticking my hand in a flame, but just really lean into them and feel really sad or really angry. And then often that's the route to release them. Like often that's the quickest route to being free of them, as opposed to trying to avoid them, because they just hang around.
They hang around in different parts of your body, turn into different diseases, God knows, manifest in some other part of your life. Right. You know, I absolutely agree. This feeling them, going through them, you know, that I do absolutely agree with you.
It's not nice, is it? It's not fun.
It's nice after it's done, right? Especially when you have that a good cry. Oh my yes. God, that feels amazing. And you know, it's like, it again, if it's in your nature to be like, think of it from a positive side or from curiosity or whatever, even through the cry you're like, oh God, I'm going to feel so good after this. You know, that's going to be the, in your mind, right? Like, you know, boo-hoo-hoo. But then it's like, it's okay. It's getting over. It's getting over. You know, that feeling.
Right. And I think that's often another way. I mean, what's interesting about the exercise I mentioned earlier, where I get people to go inside their bodies and what do you feel and how would you describe that? I always say, describe what's happening in your body as if there were a doctor here and I was going to get them to create it in somebody else's body. So rather than saying, you know, I feel happy and I'm excited, it's saying I feel like my chest has a warm flame in the middle and I feel electricity in my fingertips. And then and actually it's kind of the core of Buddhism is feel the feelings, let go of the story. And that's another thing that I've tried to do when I'm really overwhelmed by emotions. And I am a very emotional person. I think even Yes, Marsha, it's like, I'm really happy, you know. So I also get very sad. And sometimes when it feels overwhelming, that's the thing, is to be like, just start getting curious about like, okay, where do I feel this in my body? Like a scientist just being like, my stomach is tight. My throat feels closed. It's kind of tingly in my fingers. And that's another way to get myself out of the, you know, often in my head, it's either this is never going to work. I'm never going to be able to, or it's like, and then you always, and I never, and how could you? That's the stuff that I find overwhelming. And so if I can be like, where in my body do I feel this fury? You know, where in my body do I feel this terrible despair about my life? It can kind of pull me out of that enough to be like, oh, okay, I'm just having a sad day. This isn't actually necessarily what's true. This is just sad. Or even like I'm trying to make a note of when I feel happy about things. I have a file in my, so I use something called Evernote to collect ideas. It's just a kind of note-taking app. And I have a folder in there called Future Letters. And when I'm in a really good mood, which often for me is I'm only allowed one coffee a day because I have very low tolerance to caffeine. So it's usually after I have my coffee, I'm just high as a kite and I think everything's brilliant. And so I've learned to harness that. And one of the things I do is I write my future self letters, because often in those moments, something that otherwise feels very tricky feels absolutely surmountable, like absolutely something that I can deal with. And so what I'll do is I'll say, dear future Marsha, I know you're worried about this, but actually, you know, that. And so I think you're going to be fine. You're going to get through it. I believe in you. Love, past Marsha. And then when I'm having a bleak moment, I'll go into that folder. And sometimes it's just reminding myself I have been happy, because I think when I'm sad, I'm like, this is everything in my life. I am always sad and I always have been sad and I always will be sad. And so to go and read those letters from my past self that explicitly say right now you are extremely happy feels really good. And I try and do it when something good has happened with work, because over time my brain starts going, it wasn't that good. But in the moment I'm like, this is amazing. So I try and write it down so that then I can look back and be like, oh, maybe I'm not a complete loser because I did this. That's my number one thing my beast says to me is you're a loser. And so that's another thing, is like trying to take note of when I feel good, so that when I feel bad, I can say to myself, and I do literally out loud whisper to myself, you do not feel like this all of the time, Marsha. You did not feel like this at 4 o'clock yesterday. And then having that letter written is a little bit more of evidence. You didn't feel like this at 4 o'clock yesterday. And look, you even wrote to your future self to tell her.
I love that. That is so awesome. And I'm definitely, I mean, I am so with you on getting excited with coffee, because like if you're already a naturally excitable person, you know, then when coffee, I don't even have coffee every day. I save it and then, like you say, harness it, you know.
Yes.
But just writing the letters, I love that. And I often tell people, like, when I have my down times, and I can get terribly sad or dark and all these things too, right? The other extreme, like, it's like, you know, the feelings, it's like a ping pong ball or whatever, like it's going to one end and banging with the same force, it'll bang in the other end too. It's just that you're not putting it out onto the world so easily. So I always tell people that, all I do is just take a break, step away from everything, and then just sit there and remind myself that this is going to pass, because remember, you felt happy. But I like your practical tip of writing your future self a letter, so that then you have something to go and look back to. You know, that is so cool. I'm totally trying that next time.
Also, your friends might say to you, it's not that bad, and you'll think, you don't get it. But if you're saying it to yourself, you do get it. You know,
so true.
I feel like it's got much more credibility. The other thing I do is when I wrap up my Christmas decorations every year, I write the person who's unwrapping the Christmas decorations a note. So January Marsha, who's wrapping up the, and it started because I was wrapping up my Christmas lights one year and I needed to wrap them around a piece of card. And then I needed to tell my future self which end to unwrap from, because, you know, lights can get so tangled. And so I just wrote this end, start this end, please, Marshy. I call myself Marshy. That's my like nice name for each. When I'm tough love, I call myself Shandor. But when I'm being kind, I call myself Marshy. And so I said, unwrap this end, please, Marshy. And then I thought, well, that's kind of boring. So I said, hope you've had a great year. And then they've just evolved. And now it's not even about the Christmas lights anymore. I just write myself all these notes. And so, and sometimes it's kind of silly, like, oh, that thing that happened in February. And what about in the summer? That was amazing, wasn't it? By the way, your dress looks great, because I usually wear a dress. So it's a good bet if I say, your dress is looking really great today. and then when I've gone through hard times, I've actually written quite emotional letter. You can kind of tell the state of my mind in January by what the note is like. And sometimes it will be, you know, I hope whatever you've gone through this year, you're doing okay. And I really believe in you and it's going to be okay. And I had one year that just said, because I love Christmas so much, that just said, dear November, December, whatever the year was, Marshy, don't forget, whatever else is happening, this is your season. And I like stuck it up on the wall. Because I was like, true, it is my season. And so that's another thing I recommend, is like hiding future notes for yourself. Or even, I remember one year I was doing my taxes and I was going through the receipts and I was doing years worth because I'm always behind. And I was getting closer and closer to the bottom of 2014 and there was nothing for 2015 and I was starting to panic. And then I got right to the bottom. There was a note that said, dear future Marsha, your 2015 taxes are in a plastic bag in this cupboard in this place.
Oh, this is so awesome. Oh my god, this is so fun. What a fun life you must have with these, you know. Oh my god, do you do this for others too, like, you know, like your partner, your family members, whoever in your life?
You know, I don't. The closest I've come is I have one of my best friends from school. She lives in the UK now, but we often have these long email exchanges. And we had one that was so fun. We were both having a bad day and we were writing to each other. And then somehow it just evolved into us sharing really funny memories from when we were in our teens and when we were in our 20s. And it was so lovely that what I did is I use an email scheduler called Boomerang for Gmail. And you can use it for Outlook and all the other ones too. I'll link to it in the secret webpage. But what I did was I scheduled the email for 6 months into the future to both of us, so that 6 months into the future, we'd be reminded of this brilliant exchange. Because, you know, with emails, they're not like letters. You don't come across them unless you're like especially searching for something. And so sometimes I do that. If I've had really nice emails, then I'll schedule them. Or sometimes I need to remind myself of something in the future, like, you know, if you cancel a flight and you've got the which of course most of us did who were traveling a lot last year, and you have to rebook it by a certain time, I'll often schedule an email for the time when I have to rebook it to say, dear future Marshy, this is, you know, don't forget to rebook the flights. But then I'll write something. Sometimes I'll say like, this is what's happening now, or like, I hope you're doing well, or whatever. And so that's always a nice surprise because I forget that's going to happen. Or sometimes, you know, I have to email, I promise someone, oh, I'll email you again in 2 months' time. And so I write myself the email immediately then and then schedule it. And then when it comes to that time, the note comes up on my calendar. I'm like, oh gosh, I have to compose this email. What am I going to say? And then past Marsha is like, it's okay, I've done it for you. Thanks, past Marsha. You know, past Marsha really helps me. Sometimes she really doesn't help me. Sometimes it's 2 days before the workshop is due and past Marsha did not spend 5 weeks writing it. Past Marsha went on Netflix and was on Facebook too much. So then I cursed past Marsha.
Oh my god, I just love this. And you know, I could just listen to you and listen to all your stories and your insights and all these fun ideas and tricks that you have forever. Like, this is so great. you know, it's been so good chatting with you, and I'm so, so happy and grateful that you were able to make the time to be here to share all these things. And, you know, I can't wait for people to check out your secret link and then, you know, go secret webpage and then go and just really dive into the world of Yes, Yes, Marsha, because it's going to turn their lives absolutely around.
Well, my face hurts from smiling so much, which is always a good Aww. Sign at the end. Thank you. And I'd love them to. So I have that secret webpage, which is Yes, Yes, Marsha, M-A-R-S-H-A. So yesyesmarsha.com/veganosaurus, or I'm just at Yes, Yes, Marsha everywhere on social media. And so if you message me, I'd totally love to hear from you. Ping me and I'll ping you back.
Sure. And, you know, I saw your, you know, I'm subscribed to your newsletter, of course. And I saw that you are not on Clubhouse yet. But if you ever get onto Clubhouse, please let me know. Okay. I would so love to host a room with you. Like, you would make such a fun person to host a room with.
Thank you. I wrote a whole blog post about how I want to be on Clubhouse so badly, but I'm not. And this is a thing that future Marsha, like current Marsha, is very pleased to past Marsha, because I've had a lot of deadlines recently. And past Marsha wanted to go on Clubhouse so badly, but she resisted. So this is a time when I say thank you, past Marsha, because even though it would have been so fun, I would have had such a much harder time with my deadlines. But yeah, I love the idea of it, so I'm sure I'll be on there at some point.
Awesome. I'm really looking forward to catching up with you there too, and of course going back down the rabbit hole. You know, I have to tell everybody this. So when I listened to Marsha's interview on the other podcast, it is called Insight Out by Billy Samoa. Mm. On that podcast, after the podcast, and then when I spoke to Marsha, I was saying that's how I discovered her. And then she was like, yeah, that guy's really done his research. And, you know, and I'm like, you know, I don't normally do too much research. It's usually organic and I get to know my people on the show. But now I know why he did research. You can't get off that website. You want to go into the next and the next story and the next story.
Oh, thank you.
So no wonder.
Thank you so much.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to share with my audience? Any other message before we wind up?
I think just going back to storytelling, just the message that really anybody who wants to be a good storyteller can be. I've been doing this work for 8 years and I have never had a single person who wants to do it that I haven't been able to send away as a better storyteller. And in my experience, it just makes life so much nicer. It makes it easier to explain things. It makes it easier to get to know people. It makes it easier to want to work with people. Even, you know, for all the positivity we've talked about, I am British and so I have this cynical edge, and especially when I'm nervous and when I go to an event and I don't know anybody, if I'm on the stage, I'm fine. But if I'm in the audience, my overwhelming response is that I hate everybody. And I think it's because I feel like, oh, maybe you are perfect and you'll judge me because I'm not. And I found the way to stop doing that is to get people to tell you stories and then ask them, and how did you feel? And how did you feel? And what they will invariably say is like, that was scary, or I felt stupid, or something that shows they're not a perfect robot. And that's the way to stop hating. And so I really feel like stories are the key to everything, and everyone can do it. And don't be afraid to practice, because people who are good at telling stories practice all the time. They just do it in their head. They don't realize they're doing it. And so anyone can do it. And I think that it makes life so much better. And also listen to more of Susmita's podcast, because you're wonderful.
Aw, thank you. Well, thank you so much for joining. And, you know, that one link, all your other links and link to your newsletter, the website, everything's going to be in there, right? So people can just go there and find you and connect with you.
Yes. Yes, it'll all be there. And a video where I dress up and I reenact the Rocky theme tune. I mean, the Rocky, training montage, so you can watch. Here's a secret tip. When in that video, there's somebody punching me in the stomach, because that's what happens in the Rocky training montage. I mean, just pretending to, but it's my mum. That's the thing I don't say in the video. My mum is
punching me. Ah, okay. Nice.
She just happened to be saying that I needed somebody to do it. Right, so this has been so fun. Thank you so much. This has been an absolute delight.
Same here, Marsha. Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.
Wasn't that so much fun? It's such a fun episode. Marsha has a lovely energy and I could just keep chatting with her forever. And I know that, you know, when you all check out her website and watch her videos, you're all going to be totally blown away by Marsha's energy and her magic. If you enjoyed this episode as much as I did, then take a screenshot of the episode and tag me at Veganosaurus and Marsha at YesYesMarsha on Instagram and share your biggest takeaways with us. That would be lovely. You know, it'll also help the show get discovered by more people so that this kind of energy touches more lives. And of course, I'd always appreciate a rate, review, or subscribe on your favorite podcast app, especially iTunes or Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Feel Good Factor. I'm Susmita Veganosaurus, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again very soon. Bye!